Everybody adjusted to the rain delay, I think. Hope the baseball team does too. I'm going to be talking today about an episode in New York Giants baseball history called the, well, it's called by some as the affair, some as the scandal. It's the Dolan O'Connell affair or mystery and so on. And it has to do with the 1924 pennant race. In the last part of the race, the Giants were in a tight race with Pittsburgh and with Brooklyn. So I want to go over the general idea of what the scandal was, and then tell you a little bit about what interests me in it, and then also to what extent I used it in my work on Charles Stoneham, who becomes involved in the story as the owner of the Giants. I think you could approach this idea from three different ways. I think the story in and of itself is pretty interesting. It's something that to this day, baseball scholars and historians are still confused about. Nobody, given the passage of time, has come up with really what happened. We get a general sense, and Judge Landis is in the middle of this all, and he makes his contributions to the story. There's some fallout about that from somebody like Damon Runyon, even, who questioned the judgment of this result. I'll get into in a minute. So there's the Landis part of it, and then there's finally the Stoneham part of it. I want to kind of highlight that at the very end of the talk, because that's how I got involved in looking at this story to begin with. So let's talk first about what it was. First of all, a young player, Jimmy O'Connell, who came up from the San Francisco Seals, was signed by John McGraw for a considerable amount of money, so there was a great promise in him. He was a young man, rookie, and he was signed hoping that he would become part of the Giants franchise. The pennant race, as I said, was sort of tight at the very end, and the Giants were going into a series with the Phillies, and there were, you know, well, you can see from the statistics that there was, a possibility the Giants would not win another pennant. Now, they had won three, so this was something, you know, that they were, you know, quite involved in the excitement of yet another one. And the two principals in the story are Cozy Dolan and Jimmy O'Connell. Cozy Dolan was an old-timer, one of McGraw's cronies, baseball lifer. He was the third base coach. And from all that I've read about Cozy, he was quite the character. Wouldn't probably work in high intelligence for anybody, but nonetheless, he was a good old boy, good guy, knew baseball, and he knew how to talk with people. So Cozy was one of baseball's characters. So the story goes that Cozy Dolan talked to Jimmy O'Connell and said, "We're in a tight race. Maybe you can help us. You know Heinie Sand from the old days in the PCL. Why don't you go up and talk to him and make it easy? Tell him to make it easy on us. In fact, we can give him $500 if he takes it easy on us." Jimmy listened. Okay, he's a rookie. His coach is talking to him. So he approaches his friend, says, "There's 500 in it for you if you don't go hard on us today." Heinie tells his manager, "I was approached by a Giant player. There's something involved with money. I think he wants me to cooperate and maybe make some mistakes today." Now, Fletcher, somebody who'd been in the game for a while and had a good memory, realized that this was trouble, because the residue of the 1919 Black Sox was still in the air in baseball. Landis had already made his position clear, taking a broom to anybody, sweeping them out of baseball. And he was aware that this was all, he being Fletcher, was aware that this was something that he had to do something about, knowing full well that some people are accused even if they know something and don't tell, they are also eligible for permanent banishment to the hinterlands. So he, in turn, calls the president of the National League, Mr. Heidler. And Heidler takes it seriously enough, given, again, the proximity of the trouble in 1920 and in 21 and all the residue of that, including appointing a new commissioner to baseball, as you recall. So he then decides to make a phone call to the boss himself. And he explains everything to him, says that there's trouble here in the game. And Landis takes it seriously enough to decide to immediately go to New York City. Now, the Giants won the game. Sand made no errors, had four putouts, and apparently was not in any way, shape, or form of being suspected of doing anything. And besides, he had reported it. The second place team, the Brooklyn Dodgers, lost, so it made it mathematically impossible for anybody to overtake the Giants, and they won their fourth straight National League pennant. Stoneham and McGraw were happy with this because this was giving them another great feather in their cap, but they didn't have too long to celebrate because they immediately got a call from Judge Landis saying, I want to see you tomorrow in Giants' office. So Judge Landis decides to have a hearing. The first he calls are the bosses of the Giants, brings them in, he tells them what's happening, and they immediately take umbrage at this. They didn't like the fact that Heidler had gone over their heads, that's their version, and reported it to the commissioner's office rather than dealing with them directly, since they thought it might be an in-house problem. Jimmy O'Connell was, talking to Sand and Fletcher, Landis decides to bring in Jimmy O'Connell. So he brings in Jimmy O'Connell, and he talks to Jimmy, and to Landis' complete jaw-dropping astonishment, Jimmy O'Connell says, yes, I did. I offered him $500 if he'd make a few errors and help us win the pennant. Landis realizes he's got a huge problem on his hands. He says, and besides that, he says, everybody on the team knew, well, at least three guys knew about it. And he names three guys, Frank Fish, he names Ross Youngs, and he names George Kelly. And now Landis is saying, I've got a serious issue. He brings them in the presence of O'Connell, each of them says, they heard no talk about this, they had no idea about this, this was news to them. And Landis says, in later documents, Landis believed them completely and completely exonerated them from any of this hearing. Cozy Dolan was another story. Cozy Dolan drove the commissioner to fits. The commissioner asked him, did you put up, that was O'Connell said, well, the third base coach put me up to this. So they had this series of questions. Now this is kind of an early version of who's on first, because the questions kept coming, and the same answer, Cozy had one answer for all of Judge Landis's questions, and that is, I don't remember. So this went on, and finally the judge decided that he'd had enough of Cozy, and he decided that Cozy himself was implicated, and he was put on the permanently ineligible list. So two of the people involved in the Giants organization were put on the list. The judgment was two players banished and three players exonerated. For the first two or three days of this hearing, it was all hush-hush, in-house, nobody knew anything about it. But once the judgment was released, it leaked out to the press, and this became a national story, redolent, as I said, of the proximity of the national scandal with the White Sox. So newspapers picked it up all over the country. And of course, there was some, you can say, imagine some predictable fallout. Now, one interesting part of the fallout was that the old knives came out, the old long knives, the jealousies among the owners came out. And Van Johnson, who never liked John McGraw, And Barney Dreyfus, who didn't like the Giants anyway, and McGraw particularly, decided they'd use this to their advantage to say, you see, they're always involved in bad stuff. So Ben Johnson said, let's cancel the World Series. It was 3 days away. Barney Dreyfus joined in. Let's cancel the World Series, or at least get another team. By the way, Pittsburgh was close. I should leave that slide back, but I'm not going to do it because I'll jeopardize myself. So what Landis and Hadler did was they said, we're going to go on with the series. This is ridiculous. We're not going to listen to this kind of talk. And they said, as far as they're concerned, it's settled. So they move on. The World Series turns out to be an extremely exciting one. Between the first time in 4 years that another city than New York is involved in the series, the Giants are playing the Washington Senators. And it turned out that that pushed, the excitement of the series, pushed all of this Dolan-O'Connell business to the side on the newspapers. It gave, however, Cozy Dolan a chance to go and get an attorney. And the attorney he picked was none other than William Fallon, the great mouthpiece of Broadway, the man who apparently had 105 or 6 people charged with things that were never convicted. This kind of thing. He was a notorious defense attorney and was quite willing to take Cozy's case because he wanted to put Judge Landis in the docket to ask him a few embarrassing questions. So he took the case. Part of the rumors about the money that was involved in the newspapers picked up, they had all kinds of questions. The questions they had were, well if where did O'Connell get the money? And it sounds like there was some big Broadway money, maybe money that they, New York people, whenever that came up, of course, the name Arnold Rothstein came up. So he becomes now part of this story in the press. Nothing official with Landis or anything, but he's part of the rumor surrounding this story. There were questions about, from National League owners in particular, there were questions about the involvement of Stoneham and about the involvement of John McGraw. Now, Landis decides, with all this swirling around in the press, to release the transcripts of the hearing, and he publishes it in the New York Times in January of 1925, thinking that this will be the end of the matter, and he wants to take a golfing vacation. Hadler wants to go with his family somewhere. They want to get out of town, and so they want to put an end to this whole thing. The problem is that once they released the transcripts, it became murkier than ever. One thing that was missing from when the transcript arrived in the newspaper, the key document raised a whole lot of, the key document, that is to say, the confession of Jimmy O'Connell was simply missing from the transcript because the stenographer was not called in time to take his testimony. So this, of course, raised all the hackles on the part of the press, and they were saying, well, this answers nothing. The fact that Landis wants to be transparent is simply muddying the water. So they started asking other questions. They wanted to know if Dolan knew the story to be false, why didn't he say so? Not a bad question to ask. What about was he paid not to say something? They speculated, possibly. And of course, as soon as you bring up the idea of being paid, was there Broadway money behind it? A story broke in the New York Mirror. Now, the New York Mirror was really a tabloid, so you have to take this for what it's worth. But it said that gambling interests, probably Arnold Rothstein, are behind all of this idea of the fix. So then they speculated, well, who's paying Fallon's fee? He's not cheap. And they had presumed that since one of Fallon's clients was John McGraw himself, they simply speculated that McGraw and Stoneham were paying the legal fees, which also pulled them deeper into the story. Now, this is where I get involved, sort of now looking at Charles Stoneham's role. So I gave you the actual pitch of the story in itself, kind of interesting. Then Judge Landis comes into it, and he's playing his role. He was once asked by Damon Runyon about 4 years later, Judge Landis, what about that poor Jimmy O'Connell? He's out there in San Francisco, banned from baseball. He's banned from baseball. Surely he was a dupe. You've got to let him back in. And Judge Landis simply said to him, Damon, I can't let him back in. He admitted he did it. Can you imagine if I let him back in, what would happen to everybody else in baseball who said that they didn't do it either? He said, I simply can't. I like the boy, by the way, but I can't let him back into baseball. So there's that side of the story, too. But now here comes the Stoneham part, and this is the part that I find, for my own purposes in writing the biography of Charles Stoneham, extremely interesting. This scandal that was really involving baseball players sort of comes back to sort of recreate the image of Stoneham that people thought they had put down a little bit when he went into baseball. So the speculation about maybe them paying the fees for Fallon, and also the idea that maybe they were involved again in more, the Giants themselves have a shady reputation, the ghosts of Zimmerman and of Hal Chase and Benny Koff were all rising up. You know, they say, you see, that's what this organization is about, very shady. So, but they also looked into the personal life of John McGraw, himself quite a drinker and a habitué of the nightlife. They looked at Stoneham, who was par excellence an habitué of the lifestyle. He chasing Broadway showgirls, attending one of all of Arnold Rothstein's gambling joints. So all of this came up, and they said, well, he ought to really be out of baseball, shouldn't he? So some of the owners were concerned, and they said, maybe for the good of the game, we should try to remove Stoneham from the game. Well, Stoneham was a tough hombre, a tough guy with deep pockets, and he was prepared to take on anybody, be it a U.S. prosecutor, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the district attorney in New York. He had deep pockets and a grim determination that he was going to see it through. So naturally, he decided that he's going to do everything he can, and he did. He sort of weathered the storm, and suddenly after another year of the press kind of trying to dig out things, they discovered, well, maybe Stoneham he's a mysterious guy. Maybe he didn't really have too much to do with this story. Judge Landis actually supported them in an odd way. Now, you have to think back to the Benny Koff story, where even in it, Benny Koff was indicted for stealing cars and was acquitted. Nonetheless, he was banished from baseball because he was indicted. Stoneham was indicted three times. Mail fraud, perjury, and other thing. Judge Landis said, well, an indictment, he's never been convicted of anything. Besides, he's a decent owner. So with that kind of support, Stoneham pushed forward, hired a good attorney, and was fighting things in court, and in the end, persevered. Again, tenacious, deep pockets, and a willingness to let any kind of whisper, any whiff of scandal that's surrounding him just leave the air. This picture, I think, tells it all. If you look at the expression of Stoneham as he looks out over, I don't know what he's looking at, but the idea there is, catch me if you can. So that's what I have, and I will close it there.
Hi. Just obviously the following year is when the allegations emerged about Ty Cobb and Tris Speaker. What effect, if any, did this incident have on Judge Landis's efforts in that case?
I don't really have a deep understanding of that. I know the issue, and I know that Judge Landis was concerned about everything. There was a general tendency on Landis's part not to go deeper into the past, that once he took his office, he sort of decided, I need to deal with the things that are in my bailiwick, in my lap. So I'm not really privy or clear. Maybe others who know that side of the story would be able to fill you in, but I don't know how much effect it had on the Cozy, Dolan, and Jimmy O'Connell decision. Steve.
Somebody ought to write a book about this stuff. This happened just about exactly 100 years ago. right? Yes. And 100 years ago, Landis is brought in order to clean up all of the gambling scandals that are going on. The Black Sox scandal was the tip of a huge iceberg, right? This was rampant throughout the game. This incident here sure sounds legit, and it probably was. There was lots of this kind of stuff. Yet Landis is brought in to clean up the image, to get all these bad characters out of the game. Yet 100 years later, who's sponsoring baseball games? We're told to bet, as we watch the games on TV, we're told to bet on not only the game, but the inning and the strike count and everything. I don't know, if any comments about sort of the irony of how we've come full circle in 100 years?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. I don't know what to say about that. It does seem like a strange anomaly. I've actually said my bit. I'm just entertaining questions now. Thank you very much. She just told me I had 5 minutes left. I'm sorry.
Sorry, it's all right.
Yeah.
Terrific presentation. I wish my grandfather could have been here to hear it, because he was at a lot of these Giants games. He knew enough about the O'Donnell-Dolan affair from at least reading the papers. What I don't know is if my great uncle Lizzie, who was a bag man and enforcer for Arnold Rothstein, had anything to do with it. So you mentioned that Rothstein was accused and been depressed. From your research, was there any indication that Rothstein did have anything to any play any role, or if he or benefited from these shenanigans?
I didn't get all the question, but if you,
The short version of the question is: did Arnold Rothstein benefit in any way from the shenanigans? Because if he was actually involved in them, my great uncle would have been the bag man and enforcer carrying around the bet money and breaking kneecaps of those who lost and didn't pay up.
I don't know about the kneecaps much, but I do know this, that many baseball historians, and you all know their names, assume a partnership between Stoneham and Rothstein.
Right.
There isn't any evidence that I uncovered. There is a relationship. Charles Stoneham was a member of the Partridge Club in 1912, the famous, became famous in Guys and Dolls as the permanent floating crap game. That was Rothstein's invention. They just go to a different hotel every other week. But the big rollers were in there. Swope was in there, Sinclair. Even the fire chief and the police chief were in there.
You left out that Rothstein and McGraw both co-owned a pool hall. That's how my great uncle is. He met.
Yeah, he had a partnership with
both of them,
with McGraw, and there is some connection, business connections between Rothstein and Stoneham. They're nebulous and shady, and also always on the side in the shadows. But there's a pretty clear indication. Charles Stoneham testified in 1931 that he had known Arnold Rothstein for 25 years. They were in the horse racing, well, I won't say business, but Rothstein had his own stable, and so did Stoneham, and they raced each other, and they knew each other that way. Stoneham was a regular, famous example. Rothstein had a house, had a gambling house in Saratoga Springs. Some guy came in and was making a run on the house. He was down $300,000. He called Stoneham, who had a house in Saratoga Springs, and said, I need $300,000. Now, how many of us have a $300,000 in cash in our house? And Stoneham said, sure, I'll bring it right over. Well, he didn't bring it over. And by the time the guy got over there, Rothstein was on the plus side anyway. But that's the kind of relationship they had. There's also a connection pretty clear that Rothstein was bootlegging scotch and using it to drop it off in Cuba, where Stoneham had property. And that would get in. So you call that a partnership? Kind of. It looks that way.
Well, I can tell you about my great uncle's relationship with Rothstein. It ended when he was skimming the take from the big bankroll. We don't know why. We never found out. But Rothstein did. And he, to this day, Izzy Lippman is part of the infrastructure of New York City. He's holding up the Hellgate Bridge. Two taps to the head.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.